You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
I'm Andy Borowitz, sitting in for Leonard Lopate. Upward mobility has always been at the core of the American dream, the notion that if you work hard and play by the rules, you'll succeed and your children will have even more opportunities than you did. But according to Arianna Huffington, co-founder and editor of the Huffington Post, the American dream is becoming harder for the middle class to realize. In her book, Third World America, How Our Politicians Are Abandoning the Middle Class and Betraying the American Dream, she looks at the ways the middle class is shrinking and struggling and offers a plan for restoring it. The book is published by Crown, and I'm so glad it brings Arianna Huffington back to the Leonard Lopate Show today. Hi, Arianna.
It's great to be with you, Andy.
Now, I have to say, in the interest of full disclosure, that we are friends.
Yes.
And I am a writer for the Huffington Post. But I guess in the interest of full disclosure, I should also say that you have never paid me anything for any of my writings. So there's no bias. I have absolutely no bias towards you. If anything, I have a little bit of a grudge. This might actually be a good time to discuss a raise from zero, which is my current pay rate with you.
Does my eternal gratitude count?
I guess so.
Good.
But it's always a pleasure to have you. Now, this book is obviously taking on some pretty central issues in this country right now. Although I should say, I don't know if you listened to the NPR news on the way in, but the recession has been over for a while. Did you hear that?
Yes, I did. I'm sure the 26 million people who are unemployed, underemployed, or too discouraged to look for work were very happy to hear the news.
Yeah, it was a little bit of a disconnect hearing that we had such a cause to celebrate. There is tremendous, tremendous unemployment in this country and a tremendous concern that the middle class is disappearing. But first, let's see if we can define our terms a little bit. What does it mean when you say the middle class? Politicians are always talking about a middle class tax cut and protecting the middle class. And middle class has become kind of a mantra in stump speeches. But what do you say when you mean middle class in this book?
Well, I use different definitions, but the bottom line is people who have a basic financial security. It doesn't matter if you have a white collar job, a blue collar job, when you're not worried about keeping a roof over your head and putting food on the table, just basic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Homer Simpson's life,
mm-hmm.
Without having two parents working and having that nice house and all these kids and being able to support them by himself, that's a middle-class lifestyle that is completely evaporated.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do that today.
That's right. Well, is it kind of a post-war construct, the way you describe it, the idea that, you know, we – after World War II, everybody could aspire, at least was an aspirational thing, to say, well, I'll have a nice home and maybe a new house in the suburbs, and my basic needs will be I'll have a job and I'll be able to work for the same company for a long time and have a pension. When did the notion of the middle class in America really take hold?
Well, first of all, the notion of the upward mobility, which is central to the notion of the middle class, is like part of the American DNA.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as an immigrant to this country, you know, this accent is for real. I didn't just put it up for you. That's what people growing up in Greece, where I grew up, were thinking of America. You know, people wanted to come to America for a better life. That mm-hmm. was the term associated with America. And now America ranks 10th in upward mobility.
Mm-hmm.
So we have like Sweden and France and Germany doing the American dream better than we're doing it. Maybe we should sue them for copyright violation. But there is something fundamentally shifting. We have 100 million people in this country who are worse off than their parents were at a similar age.
Mm-hmm.
And 2/3 of the American people in the last NBC poll said that they expected their children to do worse. So the reason I'm sounding the alarm and the reason I call the book Third World America, even though clearly we're not yet Third World America, because I believe we are on the trajectory to become that if we don't fundamentally course correct.
Mm-hmm. Well, some parts of the country sort of look like the Third World, though.
Yes.
I mean, obviously you're sounding an alarm, so it's a sensationalist title a little bit. You're trying to get people's attention. But if you live in some of our bigger cities in America, some of the rusted out cities, it looks like the Third World. I think a lot of the images coming after Katrina, which shocked people, which shocked people to see how people were living even before the the waters rose. It is kind of a shocking contrast with what we thought the American dream was, this idea that we bigger, better, nicer. When did the tide begin to turn, in your opinion? When did this dream start slipping away?
Well, I write in the book that this has been coming for 30 years. It didn't just happen overnight. You know, the middle class didn't just lose its mojo. Mm-hmm. This is not inevitable. It didn't have to happen.
I appreciate the Greek pronunciation of mojo, by the way.
How would you pronounce it? You can play Professor Higgins.
I'm from Cleveland. I just say mojo, but I don't want to break your train of thought. So 30 years, you're talking about that's really the Reagan
election. But then, you know, during the Clinton years, we had the dot-com boom, but the income differentials did not really close. On the contrary, you know, if you go back to 40 years ago, CEOs were making 30 times as much as the average worker. Mm-hmm. Today, they're making 300 times as much. Mm-hmm. So the disparities have been growing. And on top of it, basically, our public policy has been at the mercy of special interests. So mm-hmm. credit card contracts went from a page and a half to 30 pages, and nobody can really understand or read them. And so you get these teaser rates and then skyrocketing rates of 29 and 30%. Mortgage offers, which have all those hidden tricks and traps in them. And all those things, basically, together with personal responsibility, I'm not saying that there wasn't also personal responsibility. I mean, many people bought into this idea that you could have a no down payment, no proof of income ticket to the good life.
Right. And then you could use your house as an ATM.
Exactly.
Because the value of it was going to ascend endlessly.
But just think of it, Andy. You know, if you're an addict, the drug pushers who push the drugs to you are punished harder than the addicts in our culture, right? In everything except when it comes to all these offers of the good life being peddled to the American families, whether it's by mortgage companies, credit card companies, etc.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems like when you're talking about the Reagan years and the Clinton years, they're coinciding with an age of deregulation. I mean, this was a time when a lot of our major industries were deregulated. A lot of the financial institutions were allowed to merge and become supermarkets and get bigger and bigger, and certainly benefited from lax regulation that I guess a lot of the financial instruments that got us into the trouble we're in are things that aren't regulated and that very few people understand.
We basically went from a country making things to a country making things up, you know, like CDOs and credit default swaps and toxic derivatives. Not even the CEOs of the companies really understood.
Mm-hmm. Now, what are the special interests that you feel have been instrumental in the shrinking or the disappearing of the middle class, the people who have a lot of influence in Washington, who've been stoking this particular process?
Well, just this year, while I was writing the book, we had examples of three. Obviously, we had the banks, which even after they were bailed out by the taxpayer to the tune of, you know, $800 billion, we had enough power to kill the cramdown amendment in the Senate, which would have allowed families to be able to negotiate loan modifications, to be able to keep their homes. Now, this is totally in the public interest, to be able to avoid the foreclosure epidemic, but the banks had the power to stop it.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
And why do they have so much power? We're told that they have a lot of power, but what are the instruments by which that takes place?
Well, there are a couple of instruments. Obviously, there are the direct donations to candidates, but even more important are the lobbies who have often been staffers or congressmen or members of senators. So the revolving door is extremely beneficial to the special interests because they know how to get in there and manipulate legislation. I give a lot of examples of that. So as well as the banks, this year we had proof that the deregulators have really been responsible for a lot of what's happened in the oil industry,
mm-hmm.
which is why we saw the BP oil disaster, and in the mining industry. We saw another mining disaster.
West Virginia. Mm-hmm.
Which was, again, a product of all the loopholes in the legislation.
I'm Andy Borowitz, in for Leonard Lopate. I'm talking to Arianna Huffington. We're at WNYC and WNYC.org. Well, it's the revolving door is a big problem. I mean, that is a big problem. Is there any way that can be stopped? Is that, as long as we're, I mean, to me, I feel there's a big hullabaloo about how, if you're born, say, in Kenya, you shouldn't be president of the United States. I actually think if you were chairman of Goldman Sachs, you shouldn't be allowed to be Treasury Secretary. That's a rule that I'd like to throw into the mix somehow. But is there anything that we can, I mean, it seems to me that no matter who we have as president, it's the same cast of characters from the same investment banks who wind up running our economy. Are there better candidates out there? Who would you like to see if Arianna Huffington could put somebody in charge to be Treasury Secretary or to be the head of the Securities and Exchange Commission? What are the ranks that we're not drawing from?
Well, first of all, you're absolutely right about the small cast of characters who keep appearing and reappearing in different roles. It's a little bit like a rep company, a provincial rep company. Rob Rubin as Goldman Sachs head, then Treasury Secretary, then at Citibank, and then after Citibank is bailed out to the tune of billions of dollars, he reappears as wise man telling us what to do. And nobody says, why are you talking? Why are you telling us what to do? You were there when we abolished Glass-Steagall. You were there when Citibank was crumbling. Now you're telling us that the real problem is the deficit. It's like that disconnect that we need to point out more and more. And also, that all that explains the anger. You see, I write in the book that the anger is not just among the Tea Partiers. I was just speaking to the Teamsters at their convention in Minneapolis on Sunday. They're angry too. Everybody's angry.
Who are they angry at?
You see, that's the thing. The only reason their anger is now taking a specific form is because they're really angry at everybody who's betrayed them. That's mm-hmm. why I call my book, our politicians are abandoning the middle class and betraying the American dream. They are feeling abandoned. They are feeling betrayed. On CNBC today, one of the questions for the president was, I'm exhausted at waiting and defending you. When are we actually going to take care of us? Mm-hmm. The middle class never saw, and when we say the middle class, also working people, we saw, poverty rising to over 14% mm-hmm. in the last census number. So we never saw the urgency that we saw around the imminent financial collapse. We never saw that around saving the middle class and saving jobs. So my solutions in the book, and honestly, Andy, if people were only going to read one section, I would ask them to read the solution section mm-hmm. because I feel that we all need to start focusing on solutions. Mm-hmm. And my solutions are whatever you believe the role of government should be and whatever our disagreements about that, the beyond left and right solutions involve what are we doing? What is each one of us doing? What are we doing to rebuild our communities and our lives? And that's our responsibility. And it involves building up our own financial literacy. We can no longer pretend to ourselves that all these companies offering us mortgages and credit cards have our interests at heart.
Right.
And we need to also see what are we doing to help others. And I have the most amazing stories in the book from people who, even if they're unemployed, have found the energy in themselves to do something for others. Like this man, Seth Reams, that I write about in Portland, Oregon, who lost his job as a concierge and filed hundreds of job applications. And then he also created a site called We've Got Time to Help.org, helping people who needed things in the community. And that gave him a sense of being empowered, a sense of not just being a victim of circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Well, these are acts of generosity and altruism, but in a practical sense, even if we all, let's say we all have a conversion, we read your book, or at least we read that one chapter, and we all decide that we're not going to continue with getting and spending the way we've been doing, and that we're going to start being more charitable and more involved in our localities. How will that save the middle class?
Well, I think, first of all, I'm not getting government off the hook. I mean, government mm-hmm. has a lot of things to do. But all I'm saying is that democracy is not a spectator sport.
Mm-hmm.
And we cannot just sit at the sidelines asking government to do things. The question is, what are we doing? And this is not just acts of charity. It's really transformative acts of in communities. I mean, you have lawyers in Philadelphia that I write about who lost their jobs, are underemployed, and they've come together and they've helped hundreds of people avoid foreclosure.
Mm-hmm.
So these are really acts that change people's lives. You know, we're not just talking about the traditional view of charity, you know, helping serve meals at food banks around Thanksgiving. I'm talking about using our skills, our resources, our time, whatever we have, to really make this part of our life, which also will change the way we look at our lives and the way we look at community.
Well, now, getting back to government again, because you're not letting government off the hook, President Obama right now is has very low approval ratings. He's really drawing a lot of the anger that you're talking about. Certainly the Tea Partiers are mad at him, but there are people on the from the left that are mad at him as well right now.
Well, I'm really kind of, I'm objecting to dividing everything as left and right.
Mm-hmm.
I don't.
In other words, what I just did.
Yes.
Right.
I really. Do you mind? Can you object?
No, no, no.
Can I object to what the host is saying?
You can object to that.
You know, it's like, because I think it's like it's become like a reflexive way at looking at everything,
mm-hmm.
and it stops us from finding solutions because
mm-hmm.
this has nothing to do with left and right. Mm-hmm. Everybody in this country, even the most conservative people at the top, who have nothing to worry about, who are always going to have a lot of money, don't want a country where the rich are fine, but they have to live behind gates with guards with guns protecting their kids from kidnapping. I mean,
mm-hmm.
nobody wants this country to become Mexico or Brazil, even if we are at the top of the pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, we are all in it together when it comes to finding solutions. And the anger is very legitimate because basically we saved Wall Street. But Wall Street did not return the favor. We saved Wall Street without demanding any conditions, without any strings attached. So they cut spending, and that's why one of the things, spending to rebuild jobs, that's why one of the things that I'm suggesting that people can do is move their money.
Mm-hmm.
So
What? How specifically? First of all, this is assuming people have money.
Well, even
but
if they have $100.
Okay, then
they say you have $100.
Then they take it out of Citibank and
they
put it
and
where?
You put your zip code on mm-hmm. the site we have, which is moveyourmoney.info.
Okay.
And we will let you know what are the creditworthy community banks and credit unions in your area.
Mm-hmm.
And you move your money there. The advantage of that is, first of all, it makes you feel good.
Mm-hmm.
You don't feel like a victim of circumstances. You feel like, I'm in control of my destiny. And we've had people say that to us after they've done it. Then you're moving it into local banks that are much more likely to turn around and reinvest in the community,
mm-hmm.
that are much more likely not to put all these hidden overdraft fees, all these tricks and traps in the way they deal with you. And it's part of what we're talking about, that we need to recharge the local communities
mm-hmm.
instead of the mega banks. You know, this big size, you know, too big to fail institutions are a huge problem. The latest financial reform bill did not change too big to fail, so maybe we can change it. Already 2 million people since we launched this campaign have moved their money. Have you moved your money, Andy Borovitz?
I'm not... I work for public radio, so I have no money to speak of. But if I if I move to a commercial radio station, I would certainly consider moving.
Or
my
if the
money
Huffington
to a,
Post starts
no, but
paying
I, you,
you.
Yeah, and the Huffington Post. See, I have stitched together a constellation of non-paying jobs, and plus, not to mention Borowitz Report, which is a money loser. So anyway, enough about my financial woes. I think that's all good because one thing that you know one of our problems in the country is that we do. Sometimes, as much as we complain about big government and the Tea Partiers are mad at big government, but we also ask government to fix everything at the same time. We aren't taking personal responsibility. During the Bush years, the solution to everything was to shop more. He kept on saying
right.
shop and buy houses and all that. And that's something we are very good at. But it's hard to shop when you don't have jobs. And that's the fix that we're in now, which is that we are great at consuming, but we're not working. We don't have enough jobs, enough employment. What do you think was the reason, or were the reasons that President Obama's healthcare plan drew so much ire and fury from people, when really you think about a middle class issue, everybody complains about their healthcare costs, and even very practical matters like, you know, with so many people who have kids who are coming home from college and aren't working and aren't on a medical policy, being able to keep your kid on your policy well into their 20s seems like something that middle class people should get behind. That actually helps the middle class. Why, you know, he did this thing, he got this bill passed, and he's only been suffering as a result of it, the poor man. Why are we so mad at and angry? Why did that become such a divisive sort of wedge issue? Was it because the wealthy, well-connected special interests were able to orchestrate the debate in their favor? Or?
It was a combination of things. First of all, it was the wrong priority.
Mm-hmm. So you don't think he should have begun with that?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
I mean, I think that his economic team, which was the wrong economic team, to put it mildly, with a completely Wall Street-centric view of the world, Larry Summers, Tim Geithner.
Mm-hmm.
In the book, I have a section called Brilliant Minds, Toxic Ideas.
Mm-hmm.
They basically completely underestimated the economic crisis. They kept talking of jobs and unemployment as a lagging indicator that it was all going to come around, we are on the road to recovery, et cetera, et cetera. As a result, they gave the president the wrong advice. I mean, trust me, I'm not letting the president off the hook, because personnel is policy. He picked them. And so that meant that they prioritized healthcare when they should have absolutely unequivocally prioritized jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And they did a stimulus bill which was inadequate. The problem with the stimulus bill is not that it happened, but it wasn't big enough and bold enough and targeted enough to creating jobs. And as Lloyd George said, you cannot jump across a chasm in two leaps.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they tried to do. And they fell into the abyss of ongoing long-term unemployment, which has been catastrophic, both in real terms and politically for the president and the Democrats.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope that this book is the thing that digs us out of this mess, Arianna. But it's a great book. It's really enjoyable to read, and enjoyable.
I would love to invite your listeners to come to the Third World America section of the Huffington Post and share their stories of struggle, of success, and really find each other as part of what we discussed in terms of solutions and doing our part.
Well, I'm sure they will do that. I've been speaking with Arianna Huffington. Her latest book is called Third World America: How Our Politicians Are Abandoning the Middle Class and Betraying the American Dream. It's published by Crown. And Arianna, so good to see you once again.
Great to see you, Andy. Thank you.